driving monster trucks, watch more sports, place more bets, take your pills, America, buy more soap and magazines, sweet land of liberty, where you can raise your kids to be Dairy Kings, Burger Queens. I don't want to say good night, America, and I won't pick up that glove. I don't want to say good night, America, good night, America, my love.
I should probably start. Hi, this is Mike. This is Good Night America, and we have with us Jan Ervin, who I should probably introduce myself to him, but I'll let him introduce himself to the audience first and kind of tell what his background is, because I know I ran into him not too long ago, kind of on accident, but I'll get to that in a little bit. First, let me introduce Jan, who's on the phone with us, and let us know all about your beliefs, I guess, as far as you can. I know I found out a lot of information through Gnostic media, but...
Well, I'm not sure about beliefs. I try to base what I think on primary evidence. I started off with a lot of beliefs back in 2008 when I started the show, which is a Gnostic Media podcast, and I also run a radio show on RBN from 7 to 9 Pacific time. But started off years ago doing my podcast interviewing about 55 of the world's leading psychedelic experts, and I was an ethnobotanist for many years, wrote books on the subject, and what happened was during the course of doing all of these interviews, I realized that something was severely wrong with the field and with the information and what was being sold, and so having written a couple of books in the field, I started doing a lot more digging, and rather than trusting my friends and other people in the working in the same field, writing books in the same field, professors, etc., rather than just taking their word at face value, I started looking for the primary citations. And this started in 2006, and in 2008 I published a book called The Holy Mushroom regarding the attacks on John Allegro, and I found that the entire field of ethnomycology and ethnobotany had lied about the attacks on Allegro. And I checked every one of the citations and checked all of the attacks, and all of the attacks were fabricated. And then this led me to investigate the man, R. Gordon Wasson, who led the attacks on John Allegro. And he was also the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms and the founder of the field of ethnomycology. So I started digging around in his background starting in 2008. And then by 2012, I had started amassing enough documentation to show that he was very likely an agent, but that his massive work and books were a lie.
And that's a CIA agent from what you...
Well, he was higher than a CIA agent, but yeah, he was working with Alan Dulles. He was top level. He was in the private meetings at the Council on Foreign Relations and all this stuff. But initially, I thought it was just him. He was the dirty apple in the field of ethnomycology, or the bad apple, right?
Right.
And so, but what happened was, as I began investigating his citations and checking everything, well, all of these people constantly cited him, and then I would go over and I would check their citations, and what I found was there were groups of these academics cross-citing each other, basically these academic cells, and that none of them were citing the primary citations, and if they were, they would partially cite them and take them out of context, etc. So this led me to realize that many of these people that I had worked around within the field and interviewed, et cetera, for my show were, in fact, from the intelligence community, were working with MKUltra and continued projects, and that this forefront of ethnomycology and ethnobotany and the promotion of psychedelic drugs and the media and ayahuasca retreats and, oh, MDMA for PTSD and mushrooms for PTSD, all of this stuff, it was all a big dog and pony show. And the more you went in to check the citations, the more the whole history didn't add up. The citations were faked. And the more these people started overlapping with known CIA professionals who worked in the MKUltra program.
And this is all documented in on your website, Gnostic Media. I think this article is probably the spies and
Spies in Academic Clothing.
Right,
that's
right,
the
right,
one
right.
I released in May. That's is sort of the culmination, but there, that's part five and a so far five-part series.
Yeah, and all the information is just mind-blowing. I keep thinking tie-dye spies, when so I forgot the name, I apologize.
Right,
but.
Well, it is tie-dye spies, essentially. That was, you know, I considered calling it something like that, too. That wouldn't even be a bad title for it. But, yeah, so, you know, Timothy Leary admitted that he was an agent by 1962. I also have him on video talking about underground agents in a whole room full of MKUltra researchers, people like Dr. Sidney Cohen and Oscar Janiger and Humphrey Osmond, etc. These were all key MKUltra boys and, you know, guys like, well, in the MKUltra world, essentially all roads lead to Aldous Huxley. And that was when I discovered that Aldous Huxley was one of the key architects of MKUltra. I started researching his background. So it went from investigating this one guy who made all of these bogus attacks on John Allegro in 1970, expanded out into exposing this entire MKUltra program and exposing the fact that the entire counterculture revolution, the psychedelic 60s, was in fact the MKUltra program. It's not just about this Manchurian candidate and back and all of this stuff, that the actual program itself was the counterculture revolution.
And you said, when I first asked you what your beliefs were, you quite correctly corrected me, not to use the word doubly there, but I know when I found out initially about this, because that's why I contacted you, I was just like, wow, this guy's talking exactly the same thing that I thought was happening back in the 90s, and what happened was, junior college, I took a class on argumentation and debate, or speech and debate, and my first one, my first assignment was to make an argument advocating a position, and so my that was a big stoner, so I was like, oh, you know, marijuana should be legal. And there's that big Cypress Hill album, and, you know, they quote Genesis, you know. And so I was thinking, what? I got to use the Bible in order to make this argument. So I went looking through the Bible, and I also read Jack Harar's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, which is, you know, obviously very influential. And at that point, and I started reading the Bible a little bit, there was a section in the book of Matthew that was insane. It was just like everyone who ever takes an oath or asks you takes an oath is working for the evil one. And obviously, you know, with the U.S. government, everyone takes an oath. So for my argument position, I was like, you know, the United States government must be evil and Satanist in order to make marijuana illegal, and here's proof with this passage and that passage and the other passage, kind of as a joke almost. But then after that, I read Jonathan Van Anken's book, Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes, Political Manipulation and Mind Control in America. And that kind of woke me up too a bit, and that's right around the same time. And I read a book about William Burroughs, and he went to the Los Alamos Ranch School right before it was turned into Los Alamos that we know, where they developed the atomic bomb. So all those things kind of went off in my head, and throughout the years, I just watched the propaganda and listened to music, you know what I mean, and read, you know, a book or two here or there, and it seems very obvious that the counterculture was completely manufactured. And so that's why I was very interested to have you on, because I know your work primarily starts with, I think, the 40s or 50s, with Wasson's article coming out promoting the magic mushrooms, and it goes on into the 60s, and you just mentioned in your last comment there about the Manchurian candidate, and what a lot of people don't know, and this is why I loved you, because you brought up Mae Russell and all kinds of people, but Frank Sinatra actually owned the film rights to the Manchurian candidate, and according to Mae Russell, I don't know if she's quoting the Kitty Kelly book, but she was talking about how that Manchurian Candidate film was so controversial, the studio wouldn't let him do it, and he actually had to go to Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, to get the permission in order for the studio to shoot the film, because it's about, you know, creating an assassination attempt. And Mae Russell kind of put it as he was kind of muscling JFK, like, hey, you know, I'm going to make this movie. You got to clear my friends, you know, because he's obviously mafia connected. I mean, anyone's seen the Godfather series knows that. But, so it's just kind of an interesting thing how all these things kind of play together. And it really blew my mind when you brought it up, like, and you knew the exact specific names of everyone involved, so I thought that was fantastic. But,
Well, sure, you know, and their own quotes and primary citations that anyone can go and check. That's key, instead of all these people citing each other rather than citing the primary citations. But the Manchurian Candidate, although it was a real and small aspect of MKUltra, it was not the bulk of MKUltra. What they did was they used it as a scapegoat or red herring, essentially, to distract everybody from what the MKUltra program was really about and get people, it failed, and then psychedelics escaped from the CIA and all of this stuff. They don't tell you that Albert Hoffman was French intelligence and a CIA asset who, quote-unquote, invented LSD. It was actually probably his boss, Arthur Stoll, who invented LSD sometime between 1918 and 1933, and then they shifted it back 20 years to cover up 20 years of human experimentation in Europe. But and then Tim Leary, I mentioned, being an agent, all of these other guys, Ken Kesey, we now know, was an agent as well. And they all center around Palo Alto and this area up in Northern California. We see this big huddle of them, but they also center around the Harvard social relations psychology department. I forget what it's called, but Henry A. Murray's department, founded by William James, who they all cite as the foundation for the spiritual basis of mushrooms. His book, Religious Experiences, or whatever it is, I'm forgetting the name off the top of my head. But anyway, all of this research started expanding out and exposing that the Manchurian Candidate was just this part that they threw out to give everybody a bone, and then they claimed again that was it, that the MKUltra program was shut down, and that psychedelics escaped the incompetent CIA, and well, they were just, you know, it's all just blowback, and they were just incompetent, etc. That's the official storyline. But what we don't know is that the official storyline was written by the agents themselves.
Right, and that's what I kind of liked about your work, because my kind of mantra has been like, in order to control everyone completely, control must control counter control, so to speak. Like, you got the Galilean dialectic, you got to play both sides of the game, and the key is...
Sure, that's the Hegelian dialectic, which much of this is based on, is, you know, thesis plus antithesis equals synthesis, so they try to neutralize it, which is basically a sort of middle-of-the-road fallacy, essentially.
Well, and it also just stops the argument. It only has two sides, like a yes or a no, instead of, you know, any argument could have a million different sides.
Well, and not only that, but there are the facts, and then there are lies.
Right.
And then what you do is, you know, you try to, if you're accepting a middle line or in between two things, when truth is here and a lie is over here, well, you're accepting a lie. It's a half-truth. So it's still a lie.
Right, and I really dug what you were saying, too, because what they did with the Manchurian Candidate, or the idea that MKUltra was just specifically controlling one mind, it's kind of a shell game, and you don't realize that, no, what they were doing was controlling all of our minds through this new medium of mass communication.
And through the entire psychedelic revolution, through the music. Right now, I've been doing what's going to be at least a 6 or 7 part series. We have 5 of them recorded. I'm just finishing the last touch-ups on part 4 of this entire series on music, mind control, and psychobiology.
That's the one you did with Dr. Hans Utter?
Right, and in that we reveal how the pop culture, the punk, the death metal, the rock, this is all, you know, you've heard of divide and conquer. Well, this creates division. It creates division between parents and youngsters with the, you know, I can't stand the music these kids listen to this day, right? These days. And then the kids subdivide into these different groups with the punkers and the heavy metalers and the new wavers and the emo people and the rappers, et cetera, right?
Right.
So this is all further subdivision to keep everybody, separated society.
That kind of brings me to Albert Camus had this, I don't know if you ever read the book The Rebel, but in fact, when you look at documentaries of the 1950s kind of hipster kind of scene for that time period, everyone's kind of well-dressed in the 50s, and they're all reading copies of The Rebel in the Greenwich Village, I think it was. You watch just about any documentary in New York and see this. And Albert Camus actually said, the revolution of love gives way to a revolution of hate. And it's funny because that whole 1960s sort of love revolution, you see the entire society go from pretty conservative looking and reading books to just totally looking freaked out and being on tons of drugs. And I know...
Well, who developed the whole idea of promoting love? And it was none other than their MI6 boy, Aleister Crowley.
Right, yeah, and that's what I interviewed someone about.
Juvenile Wilts, and they packaged love with this whole thing, too. And, in fact, we're covering that in part four of the series with Dr. Utter. But, that's really key. All you need is love. It's just peace, love, and understanding all of this stuff. When, in actuality, the predator essentially wants the victims to not act against his actions. So this is the type of stuff that they sell. And when we get in and we just, look and we expose John Lennon and, we've been working on exposing the Beatles, et cetera, for a while, but we expose the Rolling Stones. You know, they're all embedded, and it doesn't matter what your religious beliefs are, but these guys, they're all embedded in promoting Satanism and the occult and all of this stuff. And let me just say this very clearly. There is no difference, or at least very little, between the occult and the intelligence community. The intelligence community is the occult. The OTO, the Masons, the CIA is a secret organization, a secret society.
And that's definition what the occult
and they,
means.
And they right, and they recruit from all of these occult initiation schools, et cetera. Okay, and these are people that don't, they're generally psychopaths that don't have any qualms with lying to you, manipulating you, and they use all of this sophist trickery to create essentially what they consider alchemical effects on society. If you can cause a mass ritual like Altamont or 9/11 to affect the minds of the people and sway them in a certain direction, then you can actually affect reality, which is what, Aleister Crowley's version of magic, spelled with, ending with CK, is.
Right.
And so you cause this impact on society through all of this occult ritual. But, the music, with all of the videos and, the concerts and the rave parties and Burning Man, what you're doing is you combine music and flashing lights with suggestion. So, like, let's say, just for instance, one of the songs we talk about on the show is Blue Oyster Cult, Don't Fear the Reaper. This is actually a song suggesting suicide. And a lot of the death metal bands, very, very many of them, actually have songs that are just blatant, straight out, kill yourself.
Right, yeah. And, there's one by SOD. I think the lines are kill yourself, don't worry about no one else.
Right, but this is these are all implanting messages, and what they're actually doing is they use the music, the beat, and everything. See, what people don't realize is when you are hypnotized, when you are in a trance, as soon as you start tapping along to the music, nodding your head up and down with it, etc., you are in a trance. That's when they have you, and then that's when you are hyper-suggestible. So this is all key. And then couple that with drugs, couple that with LSD, mushrooms, ayahuasca, etc., they can imprint whatever messages on you that they want. So this is all key to how this stuff works. It's not just, the drugs. The MKUltra was about studying the music,
Oh, yeah.
And, the imagery, the dress, Vito Pelecas and Sue Pelecas, creating the whole dress and look of the hippies. You have, Aldous Huxley living right down the street from Laurel Canyon where all of this stuff is going on and all of these bands are created all overnight. Most of them are the sons and daughters of the intelligence community, and they manufacture the music, They come out with MTV. They promote the visualization. They promote the degradation, essentially, of society. What they're promoting, the end result, is essentially neo-feudalism.
Right, and I think you described that as an archaic revival. And one of the more popular bands that kind of were kind of obvious, so they told everyone they were for de-evolution, was Devo. So, you know what I mean? It's kind of odd to think that, you know, Devo was right to a certain extent.
I don't even... What song was that?
It's just the whole band name was about the human race de-evolving. That's why they chose the name Devo.
Interesting. I never knew that. So yeah, I never followed them that closely.
It was just kind of an acronym, and they were really popular on that MTV thing for a minute. But
my big band growing up in Southern California, and of course they played every single Halloween at Irvine Meadows Amphitheater with Oingo Boingo.
Yeah.
And I've been researching Danny Elfman. I don't think the rest of the band was as involved as he was. But you go back into the earlier stuff, like the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo from 1979,
the Forbidden Zone,
the movie. And Danny Elfman is right there playing Satan, and there's a whole death cult, and they're selling drugs, and they fall down into the underworld, and there's all of this stuff going on. And it's like, you know, it's so in your face. It took me 3 decades to figure it out and to start exposing it. But, you know, I mean, Oingo Boingo was where you were at if you lived in Southern California on Halloween.
Yeah, I think it was like usually between the 30th and the November the 2nd. They did like 3 shows in a row. Each one was just packed.
And I was usually in the first to third row.
See, I was always in the lawn section getting my party on, because I think I was 14 at the time. You know what I mean? But, Oingo Boingo was, especially in Southern California, I know people, music's kind of used to be regional. Now it's not. But Boingo Boingo was a hugely popular band in Southern California. And I only bring that up because when I moved to Seattle, I was, into Primus and Alice in Chains for a bit. And then I realized that everyone that lived in Seattle, those bands were marketed to them not as alternative bands like they were in Southern California, but as heavy metal bands. So if you like Primus, you were kind of a butt rocker or heavy metal kind of guy. And it's weird because in L.A. they were kind of marketed as an alternative group. And same thing with Alice in Chains.
Well, yeah, and I remember when... all the Seattle grunge bands started being played on K-Rock.
Yeah.
And I, you know, back in the day when I was mind controlled by K-Rock, and you didn't know back then, I hated it, but you didn't realize back then that all of these bands were all selling the agenda, and that's how they got on the mainstream radio in the first place.
Oh, yeah, and one great example of that, and I've tried to write about this, but it sounds so odd, I don't know, but the song they tell, like, Our Generation is Our Anthem, is Smells Like Teen Spirit, by Nirvana,
right.
And all it's saying, it's repeating over and over again, here we are now, entertain us. Here we are now, entertain us. In other words, don't be proactive, just wait for whatever's on TV, kind of demanding entertainment. We're told that's our generation's version of the Who's My Generation, is it's this Smells Like Teen Spirit, where they're just, it's just this demand for product from the consumer. And if you recall, when it happened, they really weren't the biggest band. Pearl Jam was a bit bigger than them at first, until, you know, Kurt Cobain committed suicide.
Yeah,
quote, unquote. And just
think about the name Pearl Jam.
So disgusting, right? How long did it take you to figure that out? That took me forever. I'm all, Pearl Jam, what's a Pearl Jam? I'm all, that's just disgusting. Like, but when the first band was Mother Love Bone, you know what I mean? You can kind of see the extension there from Mother Love Bone to Pearl Jam, but... Yeah, it's so in your face. It's just absolutely disgusting. And you were talking about K-Rock. That's K-R-O-Q in Los Angeles. It used to be an independent radio station where they first started popularizing music by the Sex Pistols.
Independent, quote-unquote, like all the independent stations being funded by the CIA, et cetera, and promoting all the CIA bands.
one thing to note about that, though, is they were and maybe still are, a programmer across the United States, because people would just look at their playlists that wanted a similar format station in their market, and they would just copy what K-Rock did. I know, living in L.A., we could pick up 91X out of Baja California, Mexico, kind of a San Diego station, but they would play the exact same artists as KROQ, but instead of playing like Dramarama's Anything, they would play Dramarama's Last Cigarette or Dramarama's Stephen Eady. So they were... essentially, they play a bit more Bob Marley on 91X than on KROQ, but it was essentially kind of sister stations kind of ripping each other off. And that happened, from what I understand, in the radio business. Anywhere they had an alternative quote-unquote station, especially during the 80s and 90s, was kind of just taking the playlist off of KROQ and putting that into their market.
But, you know, what's interesting is this whole, let me pull up the Copeland family. So.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. It was so in your face, too, with the police. I mean, as a kid, I thought that was a weird name for a band, but I didn't know how weird, you know, like...
So you know, we have Miles Copeland Jr. helps to found the CIA, and you just mentioned the band The Police, but Stuart Copeland was the drummer for The Police, and their albums are named after the occult, like Synchronicity leads right up to Aleister Crowley's Synchronicity stuff. And they've got their album, what is it, Zenyatta, that's got Mandata, that's got a pyramid on the front.
Right.
And then they've got an album called Ghost in the Machine, which is named after what's his name, Arthur Koestler's book Ghost in the Machine, that was all about pediomorphosis, or using the children to alter society. They named their album after this, which is just totally in your face. But Ian Copeland, Stuart Copeland's brother, I think is who it was. You know, he founds the alternative music and new wave movement. So he was probably largely behind K-Rock, but he was also behind a lot of the new wave bands like the Go-Go's. And
is he the one that put out? Was he a member of the FBI or of IRS?
Well, he founded. He founded FBI, IRS Records, and FBI Talent Agency, and, of course, his brother was in the band The Police.
Right, and you know who was also in The Police, going way back, was Andy Summers, who was in Eric Burdon in The Animals. So it takes all the way back to Laurel Canyon, too. And because Eric Burdon obviously stayed in Vito Polakis, I think, was the first one of the hippies, and... he stayed at the Log Cabin, which was previously owned by Tom Mix.
Vito Blockus created the hippies, essentially.
Yeah, and he was staying at this bitchin' house in Laurel Canyon that used to exist. I've seen the pictures, called the Log Cabin, which I think Tom Mix bought when he was building some other house because it was his favorite bar, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and we should probably give credit to Dave McGowan for this aspect of the research. My research focus is mostly on the mind control aspects and how they use the music.
Right, and it all ties in, though. What I was just going to say is, there's that video of Frank Zappa calling Vito Polakis the leader of the cult, for lack of a better term. Then he moves out of that house. Zappa moves into it. It kind of looks like he's the leader of the cult from everyone that speaks about him, even though his music seems to be anti-hippie. Everyone seems to think he's a hippie. And then he moves to New York, and then Eric Burdon from Eric Burdon and the Animals moves into the house that the leader of the cult stayed in. So it's just kind of this weird scene. Dave McGowan points out that it was all right down the street from Lookout Mountain, all right down the street from the Rand Corporation, and all these people. I know everyone's kind of more interested in the Jim Morrison, you know, admission that his dad was an admiral in the Navy right at the time the Gulf of Tonkin happened.
He wasn't just the admiral at the time the Gulf of Tonkin incident happened. He was the admiral of the boat that caused the Gulf of Tonkin.
Yeah, but to give credit to Oliver Stone, he did put that in the Doors movie as kind of a side note. It takes about 5 seconds.
Yeah, that was Admiral George Stephen Morrison was Jim Morrison's father, who launches the Vietnam War, and then Jim Morrison becomes the poster boy of the anti-war movement, you see.
Right, yeah, and he has a narrative where
there's a quote, if my website is running here, that I seems the server is overloaded, so let's see if this page loads, but there's a good quote from Stephen Hager, the former chief editor of High Times magazine. And, Stephen Hager, he was on my show years ago, and then after I began discovering all of this information on Gordon Wasson and all these key figures behind the psychedelic revolution and started searching through the actual CIA MKUltra documents and finding this stuff, Steve Hager, he came out publishing attacks on me and my work, right?
You're kidding, and, the guy from High Times? Like the cannabis cup and stuff like that, right? If I remember correctly.
Right. But see, you know, and he's got a really good quote that is way at the end of my article, and of course it's not pulling up. Let me see if I can find another version of it here. I apologize.
Oh no, it's fine. I mean, yeah, this stuff is just. But it's so crazy because when you actually, and it takes you a long time to figure it out because, like, the information you got, you obviously read and researched into things of that nature. What I got was just deciphering the propaganda coming my way. You know what I mean? Kind of like, just like, whoa, right. Hey. And like,
all right, so here's this quote, and this is from Stephen Hager, the former chief editor of High Times Magazine, and this is somebody that I hung out with a couple of times, actually. And, you know, it's funny is Jack Herer, the father of the hemp movement, always warned me about him, and Jack Herer told me that he thought that Stephen Hager was dirty. But so, and it turns out he likely is, but he says, quote, "But that's the way spooks play their games. If there's going to be a social movement against whatever you're doing, it's best if you secretly create and orchestrate that movement against yourself right away so that it never does any unintended damage to your personal fortunes." So think of this, you know, Jim Morrison's dad launches the Gulf of Tonkin and the Vietnam War. He becomes the poster boy against the war movement.
Yeah. And okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just get so excited.
Well, you know, it's the same theme. So if you think about it, you know, Stephen Hager saying this, and you think about his, you know, relation with High Times Magazine, was High Times Magazine just that, controlled opposition, just like, you know, the quote-unquote truth movement? And obviously the psychedelic revolution counterculture were controlled opposition.
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, the truth movement, I mean, that sounds like a bowel movement to me. It sounds like groupthink. You know, and that's exactly what it is because, you know, truth is you, yourself, listener, not believing me because I'm on a mic here with Mike discussing this stuff and saying, oh, well, that's fact. No. Truth is when you yourself, with your own five senses and your own hands and eyes and everything, you go and you dig up that primary citation and you check it yourself so that you know exactly what it says for yourself. That's how you know the truth. And anyone who tells you that truth doesn't exist, have the brains to realize how do they know that statement is true.
And also, if you hear someone use the term that it's relative...
Right. Well, and of course, you know, and relativity has been debunked, and Einstein was a major fraud, and he ripped off most of his work from the U.S. Patent Office. There's a 26 or 2,800-page book by John Bjerknes called The Manufacture and Sale of St. Einstein that exposes how Einstein ripped all of this off, how they promoted him, etc. You know, and he worked at Princeton University with eugenicists like Julian Huxley. Of course, Julian Huxley's brother, Aldous, was the key architect of MK Ultra.
And that's,
you know, but all of this quantum physics stuff, you know, this is to actually get you to believe that reality isn't real and that you can't trust your own five senses to look things up. So you better not even try.
And it's also, it creates magical thinking.
Right. Well, which is very listen to a Mick Goswami, this professor from Oregon State or whatever. He's always out promoting quantum physics. He's a quote-unquote quantum physics professor. But he even admits that quantum physics is the merger of science and religion. And he'll admit that none of these professors agree on quantum physics. And guess what? You know, if you can't fact-check something, if there is a contradiction, it's either a lie or an error. You don't just throw your hands up in the air and say, oh, well, I guess we can't know. We better create a quantum theory of we can't know. You know, I mean, this, you know, a contradiction is the sign of a lie or an error. It doesn't mean that you can't know or can't find truth or can't verify citations. It doesn't mean that you can't look in someone's book and know exactly what they wrote. And if you believe that nonsense, you better wake up because this is how mind control works. And I'm not telling you this so you can believe it on my authority. I'm telling you this to get you to trust yourself and go out and check things. And that is how you can free yourself and no truth. And there is no the truth. This is a big non sequitur that they like to pull. You know, oh, well, you can't know the truth. Well, what do you mean by the truth? Can I know that one apple plus one apple is two apples? Well, that's true. Can I know that I'm sitting here talking to you, Mike, and that we're having an interview? That's true. Okay, but, you know, if we make this broad, okay, well, you can't know all of creation. Well, give me a break. Pull your head out of your rear end. Instead of thinking in some grand scheme of the truth and God and all of this stuff, think in individual case-by-case instances that you can know the truth.
Okay, see, at first I thought you were going off on the 9/11 truth movement. I think it was also, I hear you talking about there a little bit, if
well,
I'm that, not
you know, well, the issue is, it is a movement like a bowel movement.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And most of it is controlled opposition and misleading, and, you know, and I don't have the time to go through and check every single claim from Loose Change and every single other 9/11 documentary, et cetera, out there. But certainly, you know, many people in the 9/11 so-called truth movement are co-opted. And just like the 60s movement, the counterculture movement,
right.
20, 30 years from now, there'll be someone like me investigating the so-called truth movement and realizing that all the leaders of the truth movement, all the quote-unquote leaders, our counterintelligence.
Right, yeah, that's one thing I like, too. I can't remember exactly where you were talking about this, but it's the election season, and Dr. Paul's son, Rand Paul, is running now. But I think you were talking about Ron Paul as sort of a red herring, and that's kind of what I thought, because he kind of got libertarians or people that are more freedom-minded to register as Republicans, you know what I mean?
You know, and that was a bait and switch, but Clinton Richardson did a whole video exposing him, too, but... you know, unfortunately, the audience didn't like it, but if you get through Clint's anger at the issue and just focus on all the data he's presenting, you can see pretty clearly that it was a bait and switch and that it was all controlled opposition, just like the Tea Party, just like the Libertarian Party, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's just, it blows me away when you see it and then you kind of feel it and, you know, it's, okay, this is all. And then when you actually find the information, and because really a lot of times you're just confirming what you already know, then that's when it's like, oh, wow, man, I didn't want to be right. You
well,
know, you know,
and with the whole psychedelic 60s and the counterculture revolution, I mean, I always believed the official story, and it wasn't, you know, and I get attacked, well, Jan Ervin, he did an about-face. Well, why? if you read my research, you would discover, and it started happening, you know, in fact, all of my current work stems directly out of my book, The Holy Mushroom, where I began investigating all of Gordon Wasson's attacks on John Allegro, and I laid out every single citation point by point there so that nobody could argue against them. And I put the exact page numbers from every book exactly where they came so anybody could check them. And I showed how every single one of Allegro's citations checked out and every single one of Wasson's claims didn't.
And
you know, but all of this, you know, was from checking the citations myself. But, of course, you know, when you learn that something is a lie, it's going to change your point of view. And, again, I've explained this on many shows, and I hear it all the time still. But, you know, it's like you have your beliefs, and then there's the evidence.
Right, yeah. And you got to question more so the person who doesn't change his mind once he's presented with the evidence. You know, so obviously people's perspectives and point of views are going to change the more information they get. That's just, you know... that should be fairly obvious to anyone with any sort of critical thinking type skills. My question to you is, I know we've gone over MKUltra a bit, but when do you think that project started? Was it post-World War II? Was it earlier? I know publicly, I think it was the 40s, if I'm not mistaken. But...
Well, there was Operation Artichoke and Bluebird in the 40s, and they, you know, and in 51 they did... they dosed the whole village of Pont Saint-Esprit with ergometrine or something to that effect that killed 7 people and made hundreds of people sick for weeks and months. And, you know, they're still covering that up. But MKUltra was officially funded in, April 1953, I believe. It could have been May, but it was when Aldous Huxley sent the letter to Humphrey Osmond requesting the mescaline, that's when MKUltra was officially funded.
Okay, so there was some sort of pre-MKUltra project going on before that, but...
Artichoke and Bluebird were the official... I'm just looking it up. Project Artichoke, I've got to... For those who are interested, on the top of the Gnostic Media website is a... link called The Brain, and you can go in there, and I have a database there where I keep all of my research updated, and people can follow along. But
and that's
Project
Artichoke, STICMEDIA for everyone.
Right, GNOSTICMedia.com. But Project Artichoke flowed into MKUltra Subproject 5, 7, 25, 27, 40, was Pont Saint Esprit, etc. And then Project Bluebird becomes 5, 7, 25, 40 as well. And then, you know, so there's definitely some overlap between those. And then there's MK Delta as well that influences MK Ultra. And MK Delta may actually be the application of what they learned in MK Ultra. So MK Delta may actually be the psychedelic revolution itself. Okay. But, of course, they're not going to hand us the documents to explain them.
No. And one thing I was just thinking of when you were speaking, fashion has a lot to play into this. I know I was just watching a documentary about the swinging 60s in London, kind of saying what was going on. And they were talking about how the women, they just showed this in the documentary. You could see the women were cutting their hair unbelievably short, kind of like the Edie Sedgwick Twiggy type style. And kind of boyish.
Itself,
and at the same time, they have all the guys growing their hair out long, kind of girlish.
Right.
And then they add in the miniskirt on top of the drugs and the rock and roll.
When you look at Bruce Jenner and all of this, this is exactly what's going on now. It's the getting rid of gender differences, et cetera, and trying to, you know, get women and men to think that they're the same and all of this stuff when we're actually quite different and we're wired very differently. You know, and Gloria Steinem was CIA. I've got an excellent quote from the former head of the CIA regarding Steinem, and he says, I might quote Miss Gloria Steinem, one of those so assisted, who commented that the CIA, quote, wanted to do what we wanted to do, present a healthy, diverse view of the United States. And then he quotes her again, I never felt I was being dictated to at all. And that's from DCI William Colby quoting Gloria Steinem. But, you know, this diverse, healthy, diverse view of the United States was actually the goal that they're after is the destruction of the family.
Right.
And, of course, if women are out having a lot of free sex and thinking that they're liberated by you know, chasing after a corporate job and cutting their hair short and acting like men, where, you know, femininity, the ultimate act of femininity is
childbirth.
And you know, but... But having a strong family unit is the opposite of communism and socialism. So, of course, they like all of these single moms because they can get them on social welfare and reliant upon the state. And then these moms are not going to retaliate against the state. And then without a father figure, the children are off balance, et cetera. And studies, time and time again show that children psychologically are far better off in families with a mother and father than in lesbian and gay families than in, you know, socialist government run situations.
Experimental housing situations. And that brings me to this point. The girl in the film about the swinging 60s, talking about free love, said it was really anti-feminist, this whole free love idea, because you're kind of a square and put down if you didn't just have sex with anyone that wanted to. Was kind of mentality.
Right. Well, that's how they sold it is, you know, you're liberating yourself, you know, leave your family, leave your children, go off and party, go off and get hypnotized by the music and the drugs and follow one of our many CIA-run cults.
Right. And then the way they just repeated it, because then in the 70s, right, you have Malcolm McLaren putting together this rock group called the Sex Pistols. Bernie Rhodes put this together another rock group called the Clash. And Joe Strummer from The Clash, his dad was an emissary, so he was a little bit older and kind of a former hippie. But, again, he has these ties to the intelligence community. And there's another guy, Bernie Rose, who's the manager of The Clash, who kind of claims that he put the Pistols together, too. But anyways, you have Malcolm McLaren putting out this music, and then his girlfriend, Vivian Westwood, putting out this odd fashion again in the 1970s with this kind of BDSM punk-type look. And they just keep repeating it, because then in the 80s, they have Tony Wilson in Manchester putting out Factory Records, which is based on Andy Warhol's factory in New York City. And then he has his nightclub, the Hacienda, which is named after Ken Kesey's ranch up there in Northern California when they were doing the acid tests. You know, so it's just crazy.
Get this, you mentioned William Burroughs earlier. He's one of the big influences that launched the punk rock scene.
Yeah.
But Henry Lawrence Garfield or Henry Rollins, you know, a lot of these bands came out of Glover Park, Washington, D.C., and they were sons and daughters of intelligence again. But let me, just to give you an example, read you some of the cults that I've tracked down, and people may be shocked at some of these, but these are cults that were headed out of the MKUltra program and surrounding intelligence organizations, but and many people are going to freak out at this first one. Alan Watts was actually one of the first recruits of MKUltra, and it appears he was also MI6, but he starts the Zen Buddhist Double Bind cult. Bill Wilson, Alcoholics Anonymous cult.
Wow.
L. Ron Hubbard, Church of Scientology cult. James Lovelock, Gaia cult. Jim Jones, Jonestown cult, which ended in murder. Michael Murphy, the Esalen cult. Dick Price, the Esalen cult. Andrea Purich, the Council of Nine. Yuri Geller, and Arrigo cult. Guy Bannister, the UFO cult.
Is that the same
Steve
Guy Bannister from the JFK assassination?
Yeah.
Wow.
Steve Jobs, Apple cult. And the apple with the bite out of it is symbolic of Eve taking the bite out of the apple in the fall. And the first Apple computers were sold for $666. Tim Leary, If cult, psychedelic revolution, psychedelic orientalism. Farmer John Griggs, Brotherhood of Eternal Love cult and mafia. Allen Ginsberg, If psychedelic revolution, psychedelic orientalism. Mircea Eliade, the Wicca cult. Houston Smith, If Eleusinian mysteries and psychedelic orientalism. Charles Manson, the Manson family cult. Albert Hoffman, bicycle day cult. Terence McKenna, the 2012 mushroom stoned ape and archaic revival cult. Daniel Pinchbeck, 2012 mushroom ascendance cults. Aldous Huxley, psychedelic revolution and Esalen cult. Ram Dass, Be Here Now, If cults. Ken Kesey, the Merry Prankster cult. Gordon Wasson, Mushrooms is Finding God and Ulysses cult. Carl Ruck, the Demeter cult. Al Hubbard, the LSD cult. Margaret Mead and Wilhelm Reich, Sexual Liberation cult. John Paul Rosenberg or Werner Erhard, the Landmark Education cult. Vito Pelekis, the Freaks cult, which started the whole Grateful Dead look and all. Arthur Kleps, the Boohoo cult. Gloria Steinem, the feminism cult. Marilyn Ferguson, the Aquarius conspiracy cult. Carla, and these are all, almost all of these people are people that we've verified since, you know, worked in some way with other intelligence officials or were directly intelligence. Carlos Castaneda, neo-shamanism, the Don Juan cult, and Tensegrity, which ended in suicide. Peter Pierce and Barbara Meyerhoff, the phony witchel and neo-shamanism cults. Gregory Bateson. He kicks off Native Revivalism, which became the Archaic Revival, promoted by Terence McKenna, and also the Double Bind, which was promoted by Alan Watts, etc. And, of course, Gregory Bateson helped to found the CIA. Julian Huxley kicked off the Transhumanism cult, and he founded the word. Joseph Campbell, Power of Myth, Star Wars cults. Joseph Campbell worked at SRI with Willis Herrmann and helped write Changing Images of Man, which is the foundation of many of these cults. Joseph Campbell was a very dirty guy. Alfred Kinsey, pedophile, NAMBLA cults. Steve Gaskin, Tennessee Farm, Church of Sandy Hook cults. John Perry Barlow, the EFF, Grateful Dead cults. Alex Gray, Art Temple, New York cults, Grateful Dead following cult. Richard Bandler and John Grinder, the NLP cults. Marshall Rosenberg, the NVC cults. Rianne Eisler, NVC cult and Dominator cult. Paul Twitchell, the Ekinkar cult. Kerry Thornley, Discordianism, and Bob Dobbs, the Church of Subgenius cult. And
right,
that's
yeah.
just that's some of them. So they created a cult for everyone.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, as you're reading off the list there, it's all of them have the same agenda, though. So
all of them have the same agenda. Nearly all of them have written and published books. I mean, nowhere else, you know, it's interesting how you can spot some of these counterintelligence agents. I mean, like, almost every single one of the Merry Pranksters wrote a book. How often do you get a bunch of hippies together on a bus, like going to a Grateful Dead concert or something? They all end up writing books, working for the UN, running major production companies and doing all of this kind of stuff. I mean, every one of these people did this kind of stuff.
And the funny thing was that trip, I think it was novelized by Tom Wolfe in the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. And if I recall correctly, I haven't read it since like right out of high school. Kesey has his whole forest like wired with sound and speakers everywhere so they can trip out in the forest. And, you know, anyways, it's this whole.
And when you plug in the music information we've been exposing, he's actually running tests on the people there. He was at Palo Alto. He worked at the hospital where they were doing MKUltra studies. And then his claim is that he stole
right.
the LSD, but come on.
I think, was it Nicholson, too, who was part of, like, the initial wave of the LSD, and then he ends up writing, the Trip with Peter Fonda, and also puts out that Crazy Monkeys movie, Head, which, if you watch it, it's just a crazy acid trip kind of movie, and Jack Nicholson then becomes one of the biggest stars in the world. But I was getting back to, with the Mary Pratchers, I think they were going to visit Timothy Leary, and when they got there, Allen Ginsberg was like, okay, this is Kinkeasy, and Leary's like, you know, who really gives a fuck, you know what I mean?
Right, well, you know, see, here's the issue, it was the Greenwich Village cell, the CIA's MKUltra cell, Greenwich Village, which was Ginsberg, Burroughs, Kerouac, etc., meeting up with the academic cell from Harvard, which was Tim Leary, Dick Alpert, Artie Lang, all of the, you know, Millbrook was a major CIA operation, meeting up with the California Palo Alto cell, essentially.
Right, and so, Ginsberg had transplanted himself, too, to the West Coast at that point. Yeah.
Right, you know, and Leary, he, you know, Ginsberg, he joins the Naropa Institute, him and Kerouac, and these guys, they're all trying to kick off an Esalen-like center, the Naropa Institute, which is the Naropa University now in Boulder, Colorado. But it is connected in heavily. It actually stemmed directly out of MKUltra, and they have the Dalai Lama, who was funded by the CIA for at least a couple of decades. Works out of there, and of course the Dalai Lama's promoting transhumanism and stuff from Aldous Huxley now, but Leary, he goes and he joins the Brotherhood of Eternal Love down in Laguna Beach, and they're up in Idlewild here in Southern California, and Leary, of course, he was an agent by 1962, but everybody would say, well, what about his arrest? Well, see, what you got to realize, folks, is that all of this stuff that the CIA does is against their own charter, okay?
Right,
it's illegal for them to operate in the United States, so they can't tell you, you know, Leary and all these guys, Kesey, everybody, they're all agents. So when their guys get busted by the local cops, they get busted by the local cops. They got to go in by the local cops. You know, and once they get into the court, you know, there'll be some back scratching. And, of course, Leary went up to San Luis Obispo Prison where, of course, he wrote the mental exams for the institution. And then he, quote-unquote, escapes, or they allow him to escape. Right, and then, Joanna Harcourt Smith of the Harcourt Smith publishing heiress, you know, she's his girlfriend or whatever. She picks him up in Algiers, whatever it was, takes him to Switzerland, but she was an agent, too.
What do you think was happening?
The issue is, though, is it's really important for people to get, because they get trumped up on these issues like these arrests, you know, Kinkeasy, the cops were after him. This stuff doesn't matter. This is local versus, you know, federal government, central intelligence agency, you know, running an operation illegally within the United States and, you know, the local cops. So, you know, like Gary Webb saying that, you know, all of these, the CIA promoting all these, right? That's what the CIA does. They promote the music. It's the central entertainment agency. They promote the music, the TV, the drugs, you know, entertainment. And I know people argue this over all the time, if the M-E-N-T on the end is just the suffix or if it's actually Latin for mind, and I guarantee it's Latin for mind.
Huh.
But, you know, it's like government, you know, it's to steer or
to
control
govern your
the mind.
Yeah. Huh.
And you know, and I've traced this all the way back through Oxford, and even in Oxford you go all the way back, you'll change it to M-I-N-T, and it still says it's mind, thoughts, thinking, etc. And so, you know, entertainment, government, all of these things, while, you know, they can claim and cover it up, oh, that's just a suffix, there is a lot more to that. Huh. You know, so you got to realize, though, that local cops and CIA intelligence community, they're for the most part separate. The intelligence community brings them in, the local cops bust them, and it keeps the whole social control cycle going.
Well, yeah, just like with the, it reminds me of the Rolling Stones with Mick Jagger and his big arrest, but at the same token, that gave him a lot of street credibility, you know, so they could also use an arrest in order to promote their anti-heroes
the
counterculture, you know what I mean?
Well, Leary gets quote-unquote, you know, Leary and Dick Alpert, Ram Dass, get quote-unquote fired from Harvard.
Right.
But you know, Leary is the first to start using this new word psychedelic created by Agent Humphrey Osmond with the help of Aldous Huxley. And Humphrey Osmond and Aldous Huxley go to Harvard to meet Leary in 1960, where Leary was already running the Harvard Psychedelic Research Project. So that means he already got the word. He was already testing it out. He recruited more than 40 Harvard doctors and hundreds of students, so they knew the new word was successful. They couldn't get people to want to try these things when they were called schizophrenogens or psychotomimetics.
And that's not a Bernays marketing deal. That was a total CIA or...
Well, I actually wrote an article called Entheogens, What's in a Name? And people can find that down toward the bottom on the front page of my website or under the articles link. But the CIA created two teams, essentially, to remarket psychedelics. So the first team is composed of primarily Humphrey Osmond, Aldous Huxley, and Abram Hoffer. And they create hallucinogen, psychotomimetic, and psychedelic, and phenerothyme is another word that didn't kick off.
Right.
And then Team 2, headed by Gordon Wasson and Professor Carl Ruck at Boston University, they create the word entheogen. So I went through in that article, which I released in November last year, and I checked all of their citations and their claims, and they all, again, they just cite each other for all of their claims. But when you actually go in and you check all of the citations, it's completely ridiculous. It's not founded. Even Maria Sabina, the shaman woman that they promoted as the saint of mushrooms, she tried to expose Wasson herself in 1981 in a book translated by Alvaro Estrada. And then, you know, in the U.S. edition, somehow Wasson was able to publish a foreword to the book to subvert her own attack against Wasson in the book.
Right, right, because she already sold the rights away to you. Oh, my God.
But she admitted that until Wasson showed up, none of the Indians had ever used the mushrooms for spiritual purposes. She was a curandera. That means cure. That's like a medicine doctor. She was a strict Catholic. Okay, and so, you know, the Indians didn't use them for spiritual purposes. And when you go in and you read, like, Modalena's reports from the 16th century and Diego Duran's reports from the 16th century, they say that the mushrooms were, you know, people wanted to commit suicide or murder with them, and, you know, and it basically readied them for sacrifice. And then you see all these thousands of sacrifices that happen. I think the Maya and the Aztecs gave their victims mushrooms and then riled them up with the music and everything to want to commit suicide or to want to sacrifice themselves.
That's crazy.
This is how they do it.
And you and Dr. Utter were talking about this, I think, on the second or third episode. I can't remember this great series. Everyone should check that out. How there was different cults, even back, I think, in Greek times, and they would, like, hurl themselves through the windows or their genitalia or something crazy. So,
well, yeah, there was a cult. Maybe we did mention that with Hans Utter's episode, and I know we covered it years ago on another show, I forget with whom. But, yeah, I mean, there were cults way back when these guys would get worked into a frenzy with music and everything, and then they would castrate themselves and then run through the village and throw their testicles through house windows.
And that's documented. So, I mean, suggesting that the Aztecs or the Mayans might have given some sort of hallucinogens to whip people up into a frenzy isn't that far-fetched if you actually look into it.
Well, you know, and we see it all throughout history, actually. And you know, so in that article in Theogens, What's in a Name, and through years of research and having been in the field myself and woken up to it, I realized that how hallucinogens work is there, you know, and in this article, I suggest or recommend that we start using the word suggestogen because they cause hypersuggestion. They cause hypersuggestion in the taker. In fact, this is why the name of these substances was so important, because the name itself affected the outcome of the experience. So if they were called schizophrenogens or psychotomimetics, nobody had a religious or spiritual experience. As soon as they renamed them to psychedelic, people started having this religious experience. All of the studies at Harvard in the 1950s, nobody reported a spiritual or mystical experience until Leary starts calling them psychedelics under Aldous Huxley and Humphrey Osmond's direction, and then suddenly we have all of these spiritual and religious experiences. We have the Good Friday experiment at the chapel there at Boston University, and then, you know, and then they know that they're on the path and how they can market these things. So, but what we also discovered is Leary, Marshall McLuhan, Aldous Huxley, they all reference Genesis of the Bible in using this as a way to destroy Christian morals and work ethic and to destroy the society.
Yeah, we were talking about, I kind of mentioned that before, how Albert Camus said the revolution of love will turn to hate. And if you really think about it, you see these hippie types nowadays, and they really do it. They just hate, and they would hate to be called hippies, but modernists, postmodernists—I don't know what you would call them nowadays—but they hate Christians for some reason. And not that, you know, I go to church a lot or anything like that, but it's just odd how it was kind of a love, tolerant kind of vibe, and then now, what is it, 30, 40 years later, it's turned into they really hate.
And they also brought in
the Eastern religions through the Beatles and things like this.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
That's complete slavery, promoting a caste system.
Absolutely.
So it's just like, it's mind-blowing once you realize it. It's one thing to know the information.
It's the Western amalgamation of the Hindu caste system, you know, and...
Whether or not you look cool or you're dressed in the right thing or taking the right drugs, yes.
But anyway, that's exactly right, you know, and the Hindu caste system is designed, you know, you're in this spot in life because of karma and because you did bad in a prior life, and so, it doesn't matter, and you don't revolt, you don't do anything, you don't act up. This is where you're supposed to be. So what they're doing is they're taking all of that, and they're selling it in the U.S. to get everybody to accept their position, and then you get all of this peace, love stuff. And you get all of this quantum physics nonsense that you can't look things up, you can't trust yourself to find answers, just rely on our authority to tell you the truth. But this is the whole idea, to break the will, and when, you know, what happens is people's self-esteem gets broken when they don't trust themselves to look things up. So actually, when you begin this process, this is actually the first thing that reestablishes itself, is your self-esteem, because, oh, hey, I know how to find answers again, or, you know,
right.
a child knows this stuff, and through years of compulsory education, they actually teach it out of us.
Yeah, that's one thing you brought up, too, which has really impressed me, and why I'm glad you're on the show today. I really appreciate it, by the way, is you brought up Charlotte Iserby in her work on the educational system, and what she had found out. I think she was under Reagan in the Department of Economic, or the Department of Education, rather. And it was kind of the communizing, I don't know whether word to describe it, of the American educational system. And she pointed out that you didn't really have to change the whole system right at once. She found out that they would change the colleges where teachers went to learn how to teach and just change their agenda at first. Columbia University was one of them, which is what struck me as odd, because Columbia, obviously, then we have Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and all these people coming out of Columbia University. But you basically just have to tell the teachers what to teach, and then eventually it kind of permeates the society and it changes the entire educational system. So I just wanted to bring that up, because Charlotte Iserby did some great work, and when you look into everything and how the educational system was changed, it was destroyed by design, or rather reimagined to be more Sovietized, I think, in my opinion, but I don't know what you think about that, but I heard you.
Well, it's
that.
Obvious that it's a socialist-communist agenda, you know, and there is no difference, in my opinion, and in many of these Zionist leaders' opinions, of there's no difference between Zionism and communism, et cetera. They admit it themselves, and, you know, a lot of these people that promote this stuff are, you know, Sabbateans and et cetera, that promote these racist Talmudic beliefs. And so their goal is to dumb down society, to direct it, and do all of this stuff. And you go into academia thinking that academics are supposed to be honest and present honest research, and boy, when you actually do real honest research and verify all the primary citations and do the digging, boy, they don't like that one bit.
No, that's when you start getting attacked. I think it's
that's when you discover the truth as well, and you've got to stand firm or you sell out, you know, and you can sell your soul or you can stand firm on your own. That's about as you know, that's what it comes down to. And so, you know, it's like the name of my show and website, Gnostic Media. You know, when I started out, I was fully into all of that stuff, and now it's kind of ironic because now I expose all of this and how it works, but the website is still Gnostic Media. It's like, all right, well, it's just going to have to be a lowercase g, you know, for Gnostic, for Gnosis, because that's where we get the word knowledge from, and knowledge is who, what, where, and when. Logic is why, rhetoric is how. So
right, and that used to be the, Yeah, that used to be the mantra for any reporting for news was who, what, when, where, why, and how.
Well, you know, I was just watching a movie the other day, and it was about a murderer, you know, and right on the movie screen, they show all these boxes that these guys are going through, who, what, where, when, why, you know, and there's no how there because that's at the end, right? You know, so all these questions are laid out, and I've seen it in a number of movies, a number of crime scene investigations, but people don't get that this is the foundation of how you gather information on anything. If you haven't asked, you know, with any information in your head, if you haven't asked who, what, where, and when before you've determined why or how, you've not personally verified that information. You know, 85% of the information in most people's heads is just junk that they heard from others,
right,
but never
yeah.
verified it. You know, and a lot of people will say, you know, well, I don't have time to verify information. Well, here's the thing is you can spend a lifetime believing a lie, but sometimes it only takes a few hours, you know, a few minutes, hours, days, weeks to find the truth on something that would otherwise have been a lie. And if you do find something to be totally different, you can write about it, you can write a book about it, and then you can free yourself from your 9-to-5 job or whatever by doing this and discovering and learning and figuring things out on your own rather than being bound to the system. So don't think that, you know, oh, well, it took me a year to dig out all the primary citations on this topic. Well, if it took you a year and you have all this research, write about it. You can publish it yourself because most of the publishing houses are dirty too. So,
yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about Grove Press. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but I don't know if we have enough time now. But
I'm not really familiar. Yeah, I do need to get going here pretty quickly.
Yeah. I know we're running out of time, but maybe at some future date. But that was kind of interesting, a little side note. He's the guy that put out William Burroughs and also put out Waiting for Godot. And he went to all these court trials with these artistic books to win freedom of speech cases and then just put out basically dime store pornography type novels
right.
with the new freedom he got. So, you know, just in closing, looking at the agenda of what's going on with these people is a bit odd. And I mean, you mentioned selling out, so it kind of brought me back to that point. William Burroughs, a lot of people think, he's a great writer, this and that, but I think the first book he did was Jack, which is all right. But then he just cut and paste and developed this new style of not writing. It was like a huge con job. It made a lot of money off of it.
They're all cons. That's the big joke is, you know, they're all con artists in one way or another. Either they're faking their work. If they're, you know, in the academic community, they create an academic cell so that they cite each other rather than the facts. You know, this is how they do this stuff. It's all based on cons, you know, and it's like, you know, the Christians were screaming this stuff from the rooftops, but when you go through all the research on MKUltra that we've exposed, on the music, you know, Dr. Hans Utter and I have exposed, et cetera, there is no doubt that it is heavily influenced by Satanism. I don't care if you're religious or not. You can stand out there as a complete agnostic or atheist or whatever, and you can still see all of the Satanism out there. And once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Right.
They are doing it whether or not you care to believe it. But once you see it, it's there.
Yeah,
you know?
That's what I was going to say, too. Do you think it's Satanism or is it Luciferianism?
I don't know. Is there much of a difference? I'm not sure.
Right. Well, I thought that Satanists kind of just took the person themselves out of the thinking of a god, and they were kind of the god, whereas Luciferians believe, you know, in, you know, Beelzebub, the Satan, you know what I mean? Kind of.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
the light,
I don't know. I guess
you know what I mean?
You know, they run together at the same death metal concerts,
right.
I'm not sure.
and it just, I'll let you go here, but when you say that stuff about the music, one thing that always crosses my mind is that ministry song, Jesus Built My Hot Rod. And right at the beginning, he's saying, you know, a lot of truth right there. He's saying Jesus was the devil, and, you know what I mean, this and that, and Jerry Lee Lewis. It's just kind of insane that it's so in your face. And that was, of course, ministry, Al Jorgensen.
I guess I never really got into ministry, so
it's pretty odd, because from what I understand, it's just right in your face right there. So I really appreciate you coming on.
You've
been very gracious with your time, and I know you're busy there, so I'll let you go, but just so many things to talk about, so I got real excited, so I apologize if I interrupted you a bit much, but thanks again for joining us at Goodnight America, and I really appreciate your time.
All right, thank you, and send me a link when you get it up.
Absolutely, and you can visit his website at GnosticMedia.com. And I would also suggest, the way I found out about you, Jan, was through the YouTube. There's a lot of, there's hours and hours of him speaking with Dr. Hans Utter, which is utterly remarkable. And,
well, we put out lots of documentaries on other stuff, too. And by the way, folks, we are, I don't do any commercials or anything. I don't have any advertisements, strictly donations and website purchases off the store page. So, you know, please support the work as well.
All right. Thanks again for your time, Jan. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Mike.